What you have described about movement towards populism or plutocracy, which I find interesting about Trump, he's mixing populism and plutocracy. Like one day he's populist, the next day he's a plutocrat. So it's a very interesting combination.
And now, The Good Fight with Yascha Monk.
In the last German elections, the far-right Alternative for Germany made big advances, gaining 13% of the vote, becoming the third strongest party in the country, in some states even the strongest party, like Saxony. This was one sign that populism is on the rise, even in countries which have long fought to be quite stable, like Germany. But it was still tempting to think that the country would ultimately carry on as it did before. It looked likely that there would be a coalition between Christian Democrats, center-right liberals, and Greens. This now seems to have fallen apart, and suddenly Germany is in a big crisis. There's no government, it's not clear how they can form a government because of the structural problem you get when populists rise, which is that either you don't have a government or parties that aren't really ideologically aligned have to somehow find a way of working together, and neither of these solutions is very good. Now, I think in the short run, there's going to be some kind of solution to this. Either you have new elections and parties somehow work across an ideological divide to put a government in place, or you will simply have a new edition of the Grand Coalition. But there are two larger problems here that this points to. The first is that it will become more and more difficult, including in proportional representation systems, to keep populists at bay. Because as they rise, it's difficult to have efficient and coherent governments. The only way of getting those governments out becomes to vote for radicals, and so they keep gaining in votes. But the second thing is not to overinterpret the differences that we see from country to country at the moment. Some countries have already been taken over by populists, including the United States. Other countries still look relatively stable. But the trend that we've been seeing is surprisingly broad and global. We've seen it in so many different places in so many different ways. And there will be moments when it's running really hot in one country and moments when other countries look a little immune to it. But make no mistake, this is a global problem. It is a long-term problem. And we shouldn't overestimate or overinterpret fluctuations in where it is worst right this moment, which country is a little ahead or behind the curve. It's a particular pleasure to have Branko Milanović as a guest today. Branko has become really famous through the Elephant Curve, which we discuss in our conversation, but he's done a lot more than that. He started working on income inequality long before it was fashionable as a PhD student in his native Yugoslavia in the mid-late 1980s. He has been an important economic scholar for a long time. He was the chief of research division of a World Bank for a while. And he has a really interesting book that I've been reading for the last days, Global Inequality, A New Approach for the Age of Globalization. And as you'll see, we talk about everything from trying to understand long-term income trends around the world and what they mean empirically and normatively for how we think about our politics, to a whole bunch of questions that are more politically urgent. Why it is that people voted for Donald Trump? Why it is that countries in Western and Central Europe have turned towards populism and what we can do about it? I hope you enjoy our conversation. I know I certainly did. Branko, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio with me today.
Thank you very much, Yascha. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
So I'm sorry to do this to you, but we've got to start with the elephant curve, which is sort of, you know, you were famous among economists for a long time, but it's sort of, you know, your greatest hit, the thing that has made you famous well beyond economics. What is the elephant curve and what does it tell us about the world?
Well, I know everybody starts with the elephant curve, so I've described it like probably hundreds of times so far. But the elephant curve, what actually does, it shows you, well, I have to describe how the curve looks like. So on the horizontal axis, it shows you position in the global income distribution. So you have really people from the percentile 1, which is really the poorest people in the world, to the percentile 100, which is the global top 1%. And then on the vertical axis, it shows this sort of a strange curvature, which really reflects the rate of growth in real income over the period between 1988 and 2011. So why it is the elephant curve? Because it really has the shape of the elephant.
So the point of the elephant is that it sort of rises slowly from the left towards the middle. It sort of peaks in the middle, right? And when it sort of goes down a little bit towards the 80th, 90th percentile, it's really quite low. It's around 0%. And then it shoots up as the trunk of the elephant shoots up, right?
Exactly. That's exactly, you actually described it much better than I could do. So that's exactly how the curve looks. And actually, that curve basically then makes you focus on 3 points, as you described. The one is this slow increase, but really a very high sort of a peak around the middle. And then you say, okay, well, these guys have really done extremely well. Their incomes have gone up by 2 times, actually, in some cases, 3 or 4 times. And then you say, who are there? Who are people there? And you find out that they are like 90% from Asia, of course, dominantly from China. It's basically a story of the Chinese middle class and growth of China. And then, as you actually described, then the curve starts really going down very significantly and comes to a point where actually there is, it's like a zero. It's hugging the zero axis, the zero level. And then you say, well, who are the people there? And then you find out that they're really dominantly lower middle classes from the rich world. So the interesting part here is also not only that they didn't have a growth, but it's also that they are still richer than the Chinese who had a very significant growth. So it's really a little bit of a, double-edged part. You know, it's not like only, you know, you have people who are poor and not growth. In this case, you have people who are relatively rich, no growth. And then the ending of the curve, as you said, actually the trunk of the elephant was that actually phenomenal, of course, growth of the top 1%. So essentially you have 3 points, you know, Chinese middle class doing very well, Western lower middle class, working class not doing well, and the plutocrats at the top doing well.
So there's a few takeaways of that from me, right? I mean, one is sort of interesting, but relatively obvious given everything we've been talking about over the past years, and that's how well the richest people in the world are doing, how well the last 25 years have been to them, the rise of the global plutocrats and so on and so forth, right? And that's very obvious in that curve. It's visually very striking, but it's sort of relatively unsurprising. The second thing is something that's a little bit more surprising if you zoom out a bit, and it's sort of confirmed in a very striking way, and I think it's what makes this graph so sort of justly celebrated. But we sort of know that as well, right? That actually when you look at former steelworkers in Michigan, they're not doing so great economically. They've had real stagnation. They're still pretty affluent by comparison to most of the world, right? I mean, compared to 79%, 89% of people in the world, you still want to be a former steelworker in Michigan, right? But there's a reason why they've been feeling economically frustrated. I mean, to me, Phil, what's actually interesting is that the biggest gains here are towards the middle of the curve. And this is something that we don't think about very much. The debate in countries like the United States or like a lot of Western Europe is sort of about the last 25, 30 years having been a really pessimistic, a really bad story. And there you see that actually, for a lot of the world, it's been a really good story. I mean, when you look at this curve, you know, what do you see in it? Do you see it as a positive message, as a negative message? What's your take on it?
You know what? I mean, if you were really to look at the world as a whole, and I cannot see that for me, it was a surprise, not only because I work with the data, but because you're exposed every day to the amazing success of China. So the fact that the people around the middle of the income distribution did so well is not really a huge surprise. We knew that all along. But is it a positive message or a negative message? You see, the key problem thing here is the following. If this curve, exactly the same, was drawn for individual country, you would say basically it's a positive message. You had really incredible rise of the middle class. People have done extremely well there. There are many of them, actually 25% of the population. Now, of course, there are some people who haven't done very well. This would be in the context of single country. That would be like sort of upper middle class because these steel workers are globally upper middle class. Then you would say, well, you know, they didn't do well, but the overall message is the inequality went down, the middle class increased, so it would be overwhelmingly positive message. The problem is when you look at this at the world, then the message changes because the political space in which these things are reflected is a nation state. So as you said rightly, actually the discussion in the West has not been, well, you know, the middle class, the Chinese and Indians and Indonesians and Vietnamese are really becoming richer. The discussion was on the top of the curve where we have actually slowed down and actually zero growth among many people. So that's why I think the reflection of that at the political space is different from pure economics.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, there's another paradox here that you're sort of starting to allude to, which is about inequality, So everybody knows that we live in an age of rising inequality, that inequality is shooting up, that the Gini coefficient, and even non-economists sort of have an understanding of the Gini coefficient in vague terms, is becoming worse. Now, that is true in practically every country in the world. Perhaps in every country in the world.
Almost, you know, there are a few exceptions, yeah.
But it is not true at the global level, right? So even if you add up, you would think that if you add up the Gini coefficient of China, which has increased, and of Germany, which has increased, and the United States, which has increased,
right,
you get a Gini coefficient for those three countries that has also increased. But actually, that's not true.
That's not true.
So explain that to us. Why is that possible and what are the implications
of that? Yeah, it's a little bit of a paradox, is because essentially what is happening, actually, let me give you the example of the world, I mean, the facts, is that you have poor countries like China and India and so forth that are growing up and they are catching up with what is called in economics converging to some extent with the rich world. So they move lots of people who are poor into the global middle class. So they fill in these spaces. I tell my students, for example, think of the following. Look at the inequality in each classroom. Let's suppose the building is divided into, you know, X classrooms. And inequality within each classroom goes up. But on the bottom floor are classrooms full of poor people, and on the top floor, classrooms full of rich people. Well, now, suppose on top of that, that you have the classrooms from the bottom like becoming closer, you know, to the classrooms on the top. So what would you say for the global inequality, that is inequality in the building? It went down, even if each individual classroom became more unequal. So that's a little bit this, I can call it the composition issue. But I agree with you that many people think, well, if classroom A became more unequal and B became more unequal, then they must be all together becoming more unequal.
There's a great legal example of this, by the way. Somebody sued one of the satellite campuses of the University of California because they said, you know, I applied, I'm a woman, and I didn't get in. And the overall admissions rates for this university is higher for men than for women. So there's gender discrimination. Now, the university's response, which won the case, was to say, well, it's true that the overall admissions ratio is higher for men than for women across our campus. But for each individual major, the admissions rate for women is higher than the admissions rate for men. And how is that possible? Well, because a higher percentage of women applying to study engineering is admitted, and a higher percentage of women applying to study English is admitted. But the admissions rate is much higher for engineering than for English, and many more women apply to major in English than we do to major in engineering.
Yeah, that's the same thing, actually. To me, it's even more difficult to understand what I meant by global inequality, because in the case of global, it seems to me that the very fact that poor countries are becoming richer has an obvious implication that inequality must be going down.
So let's go beyond the obvious implication and talk about the normative implication, right? So I don't know how to think about this, because on the one side, surely, if you care about economic distribution and you care about distributive justice, the fact that there are people who are phenomenally poor in much of the world still, and others who are very rich, people who struggle to have enough to eat, who lack electricity, who lack water, that is the most pressing injustice. And if the prize for giving people a little bit more of those goods, a little bit more of those life's necessities, is sort of rising inequality at the level of nation state, then surely that's okay. And we should really celebrate overall the elephant curve, because by and large, the people who do worst have had real improvements in their lives that translate into something very, very meaningful to them, having food on the table, right? On the other hand, our political life world is at the level of a nation state. And there are effects of living in a really unequal society that go beyond that. And so I find myself really torn. I mean, I look at, you know, this curve, and I say, well, this is tremendously good news, but it's also tremendously bad news. And I suppose it's both at the same time.
I agree with that. You know, I definitely agree. And that's why the world is a complicated place, because it really thinks we're very simple. It would not be our world, you know. But let me try to sort of discuss that a little bit more. You know, the first argument, which was really basically a cosmopolitan argument, because essentially it was a good news. And even if you can say, well, some people lost out, you know, that proverbial steel worker in Michigan lost out, but the world became a better place. Many Chinese got out of really abject poverty and became middle class. It is true from the cosmopolitan point of view, but using that, as some people have used, and I've disagreed, in the US to basically browbeat people of the working class by saying to them, look, guys, on the world level, you're really doing very well. You have a car, you have a garage, you have some house, and you should be happy that actually people who live on $1 a day are now richer. It's a politically nonsensical statement because this is not, of course, the world that they're concerned with. And, you know, you should not really ask them to be concerned with the world, which is very far away from them. And moreover, I think actually what people would say, well, you're telling me that while you're a part of the US top 1% who have done extremely well.
Right. I mean, so I think we should distinguish between, is this an argument that it makes sense to deploy politically or even to sort of respond to people who have very understandable economic frustrations too, right? I find it striking when I talk to some people, especially on sort of a further left in the United States, mm-hmm. and they claim to be internationalists and they claim to care about global equality. And they use the economic developments of the last 25, 30 years as a sort of clear argument against capitalism and certainly against globalization without taking on board that point, right? And I think there's something where they capture a real insight, which is that what globalization has done to a lot of the United States over the last 25, 30 years is a deep problem. But they sort of aren't willing to acknowledge the other side of that. And given their own professed commitments, I find that more puzzling. But let's talk, I mean, I've sort of been easing into that, but obviously this is, you know, a podcast about the rise of populism and what we can do about it. So obviously we got to end up there. How much does this research do to explain the election of somebody like Donald Trump? I mean, there's an obvious thing where you look at the curve and some of your description of it, and it's like, well, yeah, I mean, the people at the 80th, 90th percentile in the global income distribution are people who are lower middle class in the United States, which is to say exactly the kinds of people who might have voted Democrat 30, 40 years ago and are now some of the strongest supporters of Donald Trump, which are often not the very, very lowest in the economic distribution within the United States, but precisely the lower middle class, sort of what would have been called the petite bourgeoisie earlier on in Europe sometimes, who's afraid of losing their economic status and so on. But particularly, how would you respond to people who say, well, look, actually, it's all about culture and it's all about racial backlash, white resentment, white identity politics, rather than economics. Because a better predictor of who voted for Trump is, you know, your view of whether or not Barack Obama was born in Kenya and things like that.
Okay, let me just go very briefly on your last point, because I think what is interesting there is that you have now an emergence of protectionist left. I've read recently, for example, the Trotskyists in France are now in for protecting jobs in France, which is interesting because they originally, particularly Trotskyists in principle, should be internationalists. But, you know, the point is that if they become internationalists, they end up defending globalization and capitalism as it happened over the last 25, 30 years, and that's not a comfortable position that they want to be.
The anti-capitalism is stronger than internationalism.
Actually, so it's really, they're in a very, very difficult position. I think that the graph, to some extent, summarizes the difficulty of their political position. Now, to go on this question, I am a believer. I have not studied empirically, and, you know, this is not my area. But I think basically you have two explanations that you indicate.
You're allowed to be a non-economist on this podcast.
Okay, I won't tell any of your colleagues. A non-economist, but just a little bit, because I still believe that economic factors are really the dominant ones. Because there are two explanations. One explanation is to say, as I believe it's correct one, is to say that graph that we talked about and the absence of growth of the lower middle class in the US is really something that can be made, that is consistent with what happened recently in Germany, then before that with Brexit, with Trump, with Le Pen. It's really some kind of a malaise, whatever you want to call it. I mean, malaise is a very broad term, so we can put it under that term. And it is really the economics that actually then sort of allowed these other things to burst on the surface. And I think this is important to have this view, because if you have this view, then you say, well, that's the problem that needs to be fixed economically in the country, which means redistribution, social policies, or whatever else, you know, education. If your view, as, for example, in the famous statement about deplorables, is that people are somehow intrinsically racist and it's a cultural issue, then you basically say, well, there is nothing for me to do. Everything is really going swimmingly, and there are these people who are useless and who have these really crazy ideas, and economically, we are doing really very well, so we can do nothing with them. And that's why I think that actually the view that is only driven by racism, misogyny, and xenophobia is potentially wrong, because it would not allow you to fix economic problem, because you would really keep on believing that this is really issue of simply innate xenophobia and there is nothing to do about it.
I mean, I think there's people who think that there's ways of changing the discourse around identity in such a way as to win a broader coalition. So I do think that there's sort of something paradoxical there, and I've been struggling to put my finger on it over the last weeks and months. I mean, there's this weird thing where the people who basically have the most negative interpretation of the United States, who really think that the United States is all ultimately about white supremacy and so on, that's what explains everything about American history and everything about the American present and everything about the election of Donald Trump, are also the people who think we should double down on identity politics, mostly because it's what matters morally, but also by implication somehow because that's how we build a winning political coalition. And that seems to me to be strange, because supposedly there's an emerging non-white majority in the electorate. That's going to take 30 years. So if you think that in the end it's all about racial groups voting their own self-interest, then the more you make politics about race and ethnicity, the more you should think that you keep losing for the next 30 years. And the fact that we might win in 30 years if we have people like Trump in power for the next 30 years is not a very reassuring thought. So there's something paradoxical there.
Well, maybe I'm too much of an economist. I really believe that the issue is fundamental economic issue. And, you know, when people talk even of other extreme cases like the rise of fascism and all of that, I mean, literally everyone was the result of economic dislocation. In the case of Germany, as we all know, that was really, I think it was a 28% unemployment rate in 1932. So it's a no-brainer that it was economic reason. Even if you take Italy in 1922, the country was in a total disarray. And then, of course, the fascists imposed some kind of order and, of course, got support, as Hitler did, from the top bourgeoisie to actually impose order. So I think economics is the driving force. And let me just say, for example, last night I went to So Junk. It's about junk bonds and Milken. And the story, of course, the story of the 1980s and early 90s, but they are two. It's a purely economic story. It's actually the story that we are very much familiar with. It's a story of the working class in the U.S. losing jobs. And I think this is the key story. And as I explained before, I think if we don't accept this as a key story, then we will never fix the problem.
You know, one way of thinking about this is actually relatively straightforward, which is to say that we had a moment of huge political anger. So we have to do two things. We have to understand what that anger comes from, and we have to understand what form it takes. Now, I think the economic story is a huge reason of what drives that anger, right? The experience of the 80th, 90th percentile globally, the 50th percentile in the United States, of not experiencing real improvements in the living standards for the past decades, drives incredible anger, because the promise to them has been betrayed.
Right.
Now, the form that that anger takes is obviously going to depend on many factors which are non-economic. And without a doubt, the form that anger has taken for many of Trump's more hardcore supporters has been cultural and has been racial and has been deep resentment against the improvement of living conditions for minorities over the last decades. Right.
Yeah, I would agree with that, actually, you know, but that's precisely that the substantive cause, the real cause of that is economic.
Yeah.
The form which it takes. Obviously, these people are not going to take necessarily form in terms of, I really want my salary to increase by 3.2%. That's not the form that it's going to take. The form it is taking is actually, I think that is actually due to the Chinese or the African-Americans who got in front of me, or actually these, you know, people who are idle and do nothing and they survive on welfare. This is the form it's going to take. Now, of course, it could take us very long, sort of far back, to see which of what obviously people see now as having taken place. It was that kind of a cultural expression of economic malaise has been encouraged by politicians in this country for a while, because it really provided easy votes, because you just play on the cultural issues. You don't really care to give them anything, because they basically will vote for you simply because of the sort of code words that you send. And now, of course, they're quite shocked that sort of animal which was there, which they cultivated this kind of a view, well, it has burst out on stage. So that was, I think, the surprise of many people.
Now, so far, we've been talking about some of the developments at the global stage economically as a sort of complete package, right? And trying to understand what its implications are, what is good or bad about it. But of course, it's not as though we have to take or leave the economic order or take or leave globalization in its entirety. So what do you think are the kinds of changes we could or should make in order to harness the best things we see in the elephant curve, to make sure that people who 25 years ago didn't know whether they would be able to afford a real dinner, who now have, you know, decent lives, continue to experience those improvements, to make sure that more people join them in those ranks, but to also make sure that for reasons of both equity and political stability, we address the problem of lots of people in the United States, lots of people in Western Europe not experiencing improvements in their standard of living.
This is really a very difficult question, because let me put a sort of a very pessimistic story first.
Sure.
The very pessimistic story is that what we have witnessed in the last 25 or 30 years is simply the first installment of what we are going to see in the next 25 or 30 years. And why? Because although China is now becoming richer, particularly the urban parts, and the wages are now going up and so on, China is not the only country that actually can further suck out all the kind of jobs that used to define the middle class America. So after China, you would have, and you do have already, India, and then you have Ethiopia, and then you have Indonesia, and you have a lineup of the other countries. And all the results that we kind of see with the loss of what is called the routine jobs in the middle in the US lead us to believe that we could have another period of 25 or 30 years where we, with further polarization, where you would have actually people on the top doing very well, even better than they're doing now, and there will be really lots of jobs that would be temporary service jobs that cannot be replaced by, you know, foreigners far away, and they would not pay very well. So that's, I think, a very pessimistic but not unrealistic possibility that we will have really Western societies being splintered in that way, and that we would have something which used to be called in less developing society, essentially decoupling of the top from the really the hinterland, as it were.
So that's so sort of a Latin Americanization of the United States.
Yes, I think it's not an unrealistic possibility. It is something which actually the trends seem to point in that direction. And maybe actually the rich countries have really to sort of think about this.
A quick question on that, because that's a really interesting question. I mean, one of the associated issues there obviously is about automation. Right. I mean, when you're talking about routine jobs going away, one of the really big questions is, are machines really going to substitute all of those jobs? Do you have a view on that? Do you have a dog in that fight?
Not much, but I do have, well, I have a definition to have dogs in many fights. You know? That one, I think that there is a little bit of scaremongering about the effect of robotics. Let me explain why I think. I just look at the historical evidence. We have had like 200 years of technological change. And every time that you have very disruptive technological change, obviously lots of people lose. It is disruptive socially. There is huge adjustment. And actually, we are now going through such a phase because of IT revolution and also because of globalization. But on balance, these things are good because they push us forward. And every time we have the same fear that somehow this is really going to destroy society as we know it. And you know, it is true. It's going to destroy society as we know it, because there would be many jobs that would be lost. But we don't see, we are just unable cognitively, I think, to see the new jobs that would come. So what I want to say is that actually simply focusing on the job losses without seeing potential future jobs, I think is wrong.
What about the argument that there's a fundamental disanalogy between now and in the past, which is to say that it used to be that people who don't have especially high skill, or even to put it in a slightly harsher term, if you don't have sort of especially high IQ, had jobs that were needed from them, right? And the nature of those jobs changed over time. But there was always a big sector in the economy for people like that to find employment, because there wasn't a different solution than human labor to those kinds of problems. Now, the particular tasks that were needed at different stages of economic developments changed, but the basic underlying fact that you needed some just physical labor of that sort remained. Now, the argument is that the development of AI and so on may not for now be able to compete with, you know, podcasting, but it is going to be able to compete with basically anything that requires physical strength and, you know, an ability to learn a relatively straightforward routine job. And that's something that's just new, that kind of technological capacity didn't exist. Machines just were never able to rival the skills and the intelligence of humans in the lower range of a skill distribution. And as they become able to do that, the technological change is going to be fundamentally different from what it was before. Now, I don't know what to make of that argument. I'm not an economist, I'm not a technologist, but I'd love to hear you.
I see your point. Actually, this is the point that people make. It's like, well, this time is different. But, you know, the same argument, actually, if you were to take your argument and just sort of push back like the 1930s, this was the same argument. It was used that basically automation in car factories is going to replace workers, actually in the 70s, even later then, replace workers because, of course, we don't need them anymore. All the pieces would be done by robots or computers. And even further, if you go to the cotton production, all that. So I think it's actually the same argument which is made every time. Now, my sort of counter argument is going to be by necessity weak, because when people are ask me, okay, and what is going to replace the jobs of people who are physically working? The problem is, as I said, a cognitive problem, because I cannot tell you what will be the jobs of the future simply because I don't have the imagination that would actually sort of indicate such and such a job. So I will have to always say very general stuff. Well, there will be some new jobs, but you cannot say which they would be. So basically, you have this kind of 50% of the jobs that you tell people, well, they are there, but I cannot tell you what they would be. But you cannot tell them, because simply if you knew what they would be, probably you would become a billionaire. You would just invest in such jobs and create them. But again, I go back to history. I'll just give you a small detail, for example. The civil war in Yugoslavia started in the 1990s. My mother came here, and then I introduced her to my friends, and she had no idea what these guys were doing, because none of the jobs they had was a job that she could identify with, you know, because she knew who was a shoemaker and a pharmacist, a doctor, but, you know, she didn't know what was a hedge manager and a junk bond trader and stuff like that. So these were all new jobs, software engineers, life coach, which were invented in the last 20 years.
Right, right.
And likewise, we will have some jobs that we never could imagine, which would exist in the next 30 years.
Well, I mean, already the famous statistic was now more yoga teachers than coal miners, right? Which we wouldn't have predicted 25, 30 years ago. I'm going to add a second detour to the current detour, but then I promise we'll get back to Branko explaining to us how we solve all of these problems. But because you mentioned Yugoslavia, where you were born and grew up, I just returned from a conference in Prague, and I was struck by two things there. I mean, the first is just the degree to which a city like Prague has become part of the affluent West, which it had historically at various points been, and it's obviously a beautiful place. But just you walk around, I mean, you know, you could be in Barcelona, you could be in Berlin. I mean, the level of development, the level of affluence that you see is not quite, when you look at the details of the economy, it's not quite the same, but it's very large. And those countries have done phenomenally well over the last 25 years. I mean, they're not very populous, but I imagine that they would be somewhere in your graph as part of a population that has done very, very well. And at the same time, you see people in those societies be deeply frustrated with their politics, be very angry, feel really cheated out of the sort of spoils that they thought they deserve. And that's more difficult for me to understand. And by the way, you see obviously the election of populists. Babiš, the second richest man in the Czech Republic, right, and a very unpleasant populist, is doing extremely well there. You have governments in various parts of the former Yugoslavia being very populist. You have Slovakia, Poland, Hungary, all of those places, right? So what's the economic explanation there? Because I see why people in Michigan are pissed off. I don't see why people in the Czech Republic are pissed off. I mean, they're still less well off than people in Michigan, probably, but there's not a story of economic stagnation there.
Okay, I have to put like a little bit this sort of East European experience to be a little bit more pessimistic than what you were saying. First of all, really, it was not a huge success. The convergence of Eastern Europe is very weak. You know, and then you're comparing something from 27 years ago. This is more than a generation. You know, things have, of course, changed. And also the big cities have, as we know, the big cities have done quite well. The countryside and the small towns and all of that have not done as near as well. And when you look at actual numbers, the countries that have converged and they really can be considered as success cases are, I think, basically three. It's Poland, Estonia, and Albania. Czech Republic and Slovakia have done reasonably well. They have not fallen behind. Maybe they have slightly converged, but not really. It was not extraordinary.
And can you just explain again what you mean by converging this?
Converging,
context?
I meant, is that actually their rate of growth was higher by at least 1% a year than the average rate of growth of OECD countries. So basically, they grew faster. Poland is really the stellar example. So Poland has done extremely well in all respects. And Estonia close to that. And then you have a bunch of countries like Czech Republic and Slovakia and Hungary. They have done okay, but it's nothing spectacular.
And so the nature of the anger is twofold then, is it? I mean, it's saying, well, look, you promised us that we would become just like the West. You promised us that we would become just like Western Europe. And you know what? We haven't. And we're angry about that. And it's people in the countryside, which obviously are the regions that most vote for those populists, saying, you know what? You promised us that we'd become more affluent. And we've done a little bit better, but we haven't become all that much better. And we feel this growing gulf towards the urban areas, towards, you know, those people sitting in nice cafes in Prague, and we don't think that's fair. I mean, is that what's going
on? It could be, you know, take another example, which is also maybe more striking. Look at East Germany. You cannot say that East Germany has not done reasonably well. It was not spectacular, but it was reasonably well, you know, and maybe the gap, look at that, for example, from the point of view of Italy. The gap between Mezzogiorno and Northern Italy is deeper, and it has been in presence for more than, since the unification. So that was like 150 years now. German gap was actually seen to be sort of diminishing. Well, the political results, as you have seen with the AfD, now the second largest party in Germany, actually are disjointed from this. And I think something similar is happening, what you mentioned with Czech Republic. There is also, I think, there a certain amount of malaise, and I don't know if it is simply because people say, well, you promised that we would be instantaneously rich. I don't think it's as simple as that. I think there must be some resentment or unfairness, I think. It's actually high inequality, people who have made, and not only high inequality per se, but really people who have made money through corruption. I think disbelief in the political process, because the fact is that when you look at East European countries and the West, except the West is a little bit more hidden. But essentially, politicians are entrepreneurs. So you go into politics essentially to make money.
Yeah.
And that really sort of demeans the whole political thing, because you see these people are really thieves fundamentally. And I think that actually undermines the sort of idea of democracy.
Yeah, I promise this will be the last detour, but I'm actually going to take a third detour and proudly announce it, because it actually brings up another question that I've been trying to struggle through, which is, what is it that ultimately matters? Is it absolute income mobility, or is it income inequality? Right? So on one theory of what's been going on in North America and Western Europe and so on, the problem is that we've had growing inequality and people are pissed off about that. On another theory, it's, and this is obviously related, but slightly separate conceptually. Another theory is like, no, it's not that they're pissed off in itself because, you know, Kim Kardashian has made a lot of money. They are pissed off because they don't feel like their life is getting better, and they're afraid for how well that child is going to do. When you look at the experience of Central Europe, where there has been absolute income mobility, but also growing inequality, as well as North America, Western Europe, and so on. Do you have a sense of which of those two explanations is more plausible, or is it a little bit of each?
I think it's a little bit of each. And, you know, this is not a way to sort of avoid answering the question, but I think that they're interlinked. I think what is happening, I think particularly in the United States, is a movement, which I think is potentially very concerning. The following movement is that you have people who are, of course, during their lifetimes made lots of money, many of them, you know, whether it is financial sector or whatever. And then they have also been able to invest. So they basically now have what was interesting, significant incomes from labor and significant incomes from capital. And they are transmitting these advantages to their children.
Mm.
And I think what is interesting there, the transmission of the advantage is different. This is actually going to be my next book. Different from the past, when you had like rich sort of rentier capitalists, and they say, okay, son, this is actually, I'm going to give you this factory.
Yeah.
It's different now, because now what they're giving these children are giving all the sort of connections, money, plus extremely good education, which is very expensive, and which would actually make them as well meritocrats under the quote-unquote. So actually that kind of thing is going to go not in perpetuity, but for several generations. And it would be much less, how should I say, obviously unfair, in the sense that you don't have these offsprings or a second generation who are just sort of inherited wealth and they're just spending it on parties. They are actually really also working hard, probably in the financial sector like the parents or some other IT or whatever would be the new sector. So I think it is potentially leading to a sort of reinforcing that top class. And in that sense, you see the linkage between the two things that you mentioned, inequality and then intergenerational and transmission of that advantage.
I promise we've come to the end of our detours and we're going back to the heart of the matter, which is what to do about all of this. So how do we try to disaggregate the good parts of the elephant curve and the bad parts of the elephant curve? How do we have a big, is it called a hump on an elephant?
Yes.
The big middle part without the sort of drop before the trunk starts. This is, I nailed the description of the elephant curve the first time around. This is a complete mess, Peter.
You know, this is, of course, a very difficult part because we are much better, at least I am much better, in description, analysis, and recommendations are very difficult. But let me just step back for a minute. What is interesting, just to realize the sort of the interesting nature of this conversation, because we are really discussing now how should rich Western countries adjust to globalization. And that's not something that you would have expected that we would discuss 20 years ago. If you look, for example, now there was a Pew Research Trust that did kind of a survey. The highest support for globalization and capitalism is in what country? The country that was bombed by the United States Vietnam. So that it should not become communist, Vietnam. And where is the lower support for globalization? France. So we have really a total reversal of what we would have theoretically thought like 20 or 30 years
fascinating.
Ago. Fascinating. It's quite fascinating, actually, because, of course, globalization has done pretty well for the countries like Vietnam. So then we have to question, okay, so how do we make globalization, which is working for the world and even working for the West, but it's not working for some groups of people in the West that are politically salient or maybe powerful, how do we make it better? And really the answer there is, I'm going to say, you know, relatively trite things. Well, there is social welfare benefits and social policy. There is education and retraining. Everybody has been talking about that. And there is what I maybe add to that mix is what is really related to my last comment that we were discussing is actually an attempt to deconcentrate ownership of financial capital because it has become really very, very concentrated. And we have large segments of the people who other than their housing and then partially only housing because, as you know, it's owned by mortgages or by companies, they really have nothing else. So it's actually in that sense, I think we should really move to some kind of, when I say redistribution, I'm meaning redistribution of endowments rather than only current income, increasing tax rates and so forth. That would be, I would say, the answer, you know, but it's
so,
not
so what would you include under endowments in that term for people who are not economists? And
right.
And what would that policy look like?
I sort of skipped on that because I wanted to actually define the endowments should in principle mean equalization of human capital or skills, which means that actually having easier access to best schools and in better public education. Because really, the issue there is actually, we see that in the US in an extreme case, and Europe is moving there too, is that you have private schools that are richer, that you have to pay a lot of money to go in, and that actually then guarantee you very high earnings in the future. Because the assumption is if you have gone there, you really should make money.
And the American public education system is a bizarre system of endowment as well, because by your parents' ability to build a home in a nice area with a good school district, your children then, so a financial endowment
that's
that your
true.
Parents have, which is the ownership of a house, you then build more educational endowment or human resource endowment because you get to go to a good school without even paying those fees because they're financed by collective taxes. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's, of course, that's historically the system as we know that, you know, U.S. education was decentralized. But U.S. has been in the earlier ages famous, obviously, for having really huge, I mean, important colleges like Harvard, Yale, and others, but had a very strong backbone of excellent state colleges, state universities.
Yeah.
And this is changing. So I think that that's where one sort of action should be taken is really access to the best education facilities for everybody. And not tokenism. We do have tokenism. You know, you have Malila going to Harvard and stuff like
that. But let me challenge you on that for a moment. So I agree that, you know, when you look at how unequal the economic origin of people at Harvard and Yale and so on is, it's just, I mean, frankly, disgusting, right? I mean, I forget the exact numbers. I think in some of those colleges, 50 or 60%
yeah, we have
of the undergraduate student bodies that come from the top 1% within the United States.
Right, not global,
right. But here's my challenge, right? If you go to, you know, the University of Texas at San Marcos, which is not one of the top colleges in the country by any stretch of the imagination, where do you end up in the global income distribution? Surely you actually wind up well above the 80th or 90th percentile. You actually end up as part of a population that has had gains over the last 30 years. So I agree that improving the quality of education that is offered there is important. Improving access, not just to Harvard, but to the University of Texas San Marcos, is also very important. But it's not clear to me that that addresses the problems of the middle in the United States or the lower middle in the United States that doesn't end up going there. Perhaps they've gone to a community college or they haven't gone to college at all.
Well, I think it would address to some extent, because if we sort of have this slightly dystopian maybe view of the future, that actually the rich societies would be bifurcated into the highly skilled and then, you know, service sector and so on, the more highly skilled jobs you can actually produce, I mean, produce, have, the better it is. And then if you have more broadly shared education and ability of the best people to go to the best schools, then you would have more of those people fulfilling the jobs that would be satisfying and would pay well and so forth. And then you would be able to compete well. Let me give you an example. Take Estonia, that I mentioned as a success case, which has really done extremely well in, you know, electronics, computers and stuff like that. Clearly, that was the education thing. The thing is, actually, they have decided to zoom into something which is the most sort of propulsive, more successful sector. They have produced people to do that, and they have done very well. And then the other countries that have not gone for that, they have actually fallen behind. So it is, I think, the countries would compete in that ability to really grab, for most of their population, the sort of appealing jobs of the future, and where education will play the role.
So I agree with that largely. What else can we do to equalize the distribution of endowments? So, I mean, one thing is heavy investment in education. I certainly agree with that. Does there also have to be a more redistributive angle? Does there also have to be some form of actually taxing people's capital holdings?
Well, two other things, actually. So education, one part of endowment, sorry, is education. The second part of endowment is your capital, essentially financial capital. I leave housing aside, because basically we have two types of sort of capital endowments. You have shares and all the, you know, securities and papers, financial capital, and then you have housing. Now, there, what I think could be done is actually paying much more attention to that than in the past. And that would imply undoing enormous amount of loopholes which were actually profiting only the rich. You know, we have seen actually Trump paying zero tax rate. I've talked to my attorney, because now I'm paying U.S. taxes. He says, well, this is nothing unusual. He says, my clients, we're talking about Washington, D.C., most of my rich clients pay 4 or 5% tax. Why? Because they, of course, have use all of these sort of upstream deductions, which they really reduce their income. Basically, they convert their spending into the expenses. This is actually phenomenal. You actually live and spend, you know, you go to restaurants, you travel and all of that, and that should really come out as your income. But no, for them, it's an expense. So that's what actually we have now. Rather than spending all the sort of tax expenditure de facto on the rich, you should, I think, have much greater advantages given to the middle class. So the objective should be to try to diversify financial holdings. I'm not saying that's easy, but I think it's a worthwhile objective, you know, and then including even guaranteeing to people who actually have very little amount of money in financial assets, maybe $5,000, guaranteeing them the floor, like suppose zero real return, so that actually they don't get wiped out immediately if there is a decline in the stock market. So there must be things there. And then final one is also that we should really think, go for taxing inheritance much more. And actually there we have had, of course, the opposite movement towards basically, I think there was something only like, I think 100,000 people in the US actually pay inheritance tax. The numbers are really minimal because the threshold at which you start paying it is extremely high.
What about a capital tax?
Well, you know, I think the capital should be taxed as it was at the same rate as labor income. You know, when Reagan ran for the election, actually he ran on a platform saying we should equalize capital taxation and labor taxation. Mm. We have gone so far now that actually, as you know, capital is taxed at 18 or 20% and labor is taxed, you know, at marginal rates for high labor incomes are almost 40%. So it's actually, it also, it's paradoxical, but an ideology of seeing capitalists as job providers has led us to actually have this markedly different taxation rate between the two.
So I want to do a simple thing at the end. So in your book, Global Inequality, A New Approach for the Age of Globalization, I think we've covered some of the themes in the book. There's lots more to learn from the book. But one of the little riffs that I enjoyed was that you went back and read all of the economics books particularly, but some sort of broader books as well that try to predict the future over a reasonably broad span of time. And you identify sort of three basic mistakes that people made. What were those mistakes and what can we learn from them today? What predictions that we tend to make today do you think actually might be wrong because they really remind you of the traps that we fell into in the past?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that. It was a little bit of a shocker for me, and I cannot remember why I had this idea, but it turned out, I think, to have been a good idea. I went actually and reread. Some of them I read before, some of them I reread them again, and some I really read for the first time. Really very popular books in the 1970s, which were talking about, you know, what will happen in the future, like Daniel Bell, like then Galbraith, and so on. And the three mistakes which I made, which are actually sort of a glaring mistakes when you read them now. First, no book actually saw that there would be sort of Thatcher Reagan revolution, so the rejection of certain features of welfare state. So nobody saw that. Secondly, China is not in the books. That's the most amazing thing. Nowadays, you cannot write any book. You can write a book about pharmacists. You cannot not mention China. But there, China was nowhere because it was really not within. It was still Maoist times. China was not there. They were looking in the future.
And you could imagine, by the way, that a country like Nigeria really takes off over the next 50 years. It's not unimaginable. We would look back at today and say, why is that what you're talking about Nigeria, right? Yeah.
Could be, you know, or for example, Brazil, you know. But I will say what I think would be my license from that. And the third one, which they missed out totally, was the end of communism. So that was obviously not. So what did they learn from that? I really learned from that that we really should not believe or should not make really, huge projections and sort of claims about the future. And we have seen this again, look at the past, you know, all the great economists that we have, they're all been basically wrong in their projections. I mean, I can go on, you know, Schumpeter believed that, of course, large-scale production, which is communist essentially would reduce cost of production, so they would dominate. You have Marx who believed that there would be a decline in the rate of profit, so the capitalists would produce at zero. You have Ricardo who believed that all the rents will go into the hands of landlords. So we have been wrong. So we should not really project, nor should people take our projections too seriously, because it's very, you know, we believe, and I think it's a fundamental issue, we believe that the future is going to be kind of a replica or extension of the present.
But as and particularly, as you put in the book, not just the present, but of recent trends.
Recent trends, right? Yes.
So look, I mean, I think I'm somewhat guilty of that, and it's difficult not to be. But when I look at the political realm, I see some deep drivers of populist anger, including some of the economic developments we've been talking about, also some cultural ones, technological ones. I see the degree to which populist parties and movements are gathering strength around North America and Western Europe, and actually in the real sort of populist belt in Central Europe, where you grew up. And it's easy to say, well, this will continue. And it'll really challenge, in my mind, the very survival of liberal democracy. Do you think that your rereading of those books from the 1970s should make me skeptical of that fear or that instinct?
No, I would, you know, obviously, this, I don't want to be sort of, negativist in the sense that we should not do anything. Obviously, we have to project based on the current trends and what seems to us to be like salient features, which will carry on into the future. So it's not all wrong. It is just, I think, that we have to be a little bit humble. What you have described about, you know, sort of movement towards populism or we'll talk, or actually, which I find interesting about Trump, we didn't talk about that, but this kind of a mixture, he's mixing populism and plutocracy, like one day he's populist, the next day he's a plutocrat. So it's a very interesting combination. You might also see a little bit of that in Macron, which people have not noticed yet, but he also is mixing.
How so?
Well, I think actually in the case of Macron, he's actually having very liberal core, which was actually attempt to flexibilize labor and all of that. But then there is a populist core on migration. So it's like a two-pronged strategy. He wants actually to cut East European migration, and he wants definitely to cut migration from the North Africa and from the Middle East into EU. So it's a two-pronged. So there is the first type of policies are going to benefit.
So his rhetoric on migration is not populist at all, right? So, I mean, I think that sort of it depends a little bit. Well, so to me, one of the cores of populist rhetoric on things like migration is basically say that there's the real people, and then there's everybody else. And real people for right-wing populists usually is defined ethnically, right? It's clear for Trump, in the famous case where he talks about a judge of Mexican heritage and says, well, you know, she's not really an American judge. I forget exactly the thing he said, right?
Whereas Macron, I agree with you on that. I agree with you on that. He doesn't use of rhetorically, and the use of words is definitely not like that. But in terms of policies, it is a policy whose aim is not too dissimilar from Marine Le Pen, is actually reduce migration into France. And that's, I would say, it's a populist part of the sort of, not vocabulary only, they use vocabulary, but they want also to reduce, and he doesn't use vocabulary of that, but wants to reduce. So I think actually going back to the question about the projections, so I think we should do definitely project what we believe was reasonable, but the problem is if you were really in these reasonable projections to introduce some things like, for example, oh, Nigeria is going to become a world power, it would seem kind of odd. So where did it come from? And yet it might prove, with hindsight afterwards, it might prove to have been a good guess. You know?
Well, perhaps the methodological implication is the following one, right? Which is that any one sort of offbeat prediction seems silly.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, if I sit here and say, you know what, I am telling you Nigeria is going to be, you know, a leading power in the way that China is today, it just seems too random. But we also know that some offbeat projections predictions will in fact come to be true. So perhaps actually what we should be doing more of is sitting down and coming up with 30 or 40, you know, plausible offbeat projections, right? There's a reason to think why I said Nigeria rather than Macedonia, right? And then say, okay, and so the best we can come to understanding the future is to say that 5 out of those 40 might prove true. So I think we have the thing we're going to do when I have you back on the podcast, Branko.
Well, that would be great, actually. And then let's look at my projections in 10 years and see how I have done.
That's an even tougher reappearance. All right. Thank you so much for coming
in
today.
Thank you very much, Yasha. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Good Fight. Lots of listeners have been spreading the word about this show. If you too have been enjoying this podcast, please be like them. Rate the show on iTunes. Tell your friends all about it. Share it on Facebook or Twitter. And finally, please mail suggestions for great guests or comments about the show to thegoodfight@newamerica.org.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from New America. This recording carries a Creative Commons 4.0 international license, thanks to Silent Partner for their song, Chess Pieces. To learn more about New America, please visit newamerica.org.